Well, they say that you shouldn't mix religion and politics, and so that means my sermon is doomed from the start, because we're looking at a religious text in Genesis chapter 27 with some family politics going on in it, and it actually reminds me of the 2016 presidential election. And before you get too nervous, this is a political illustration. I don't have a political point or a political agenda or a candidate that I'm trying to get you to consider. Back in 2016, I was 39, so this was the sixth time that I had voted in a presidential election, but it was the first time that I could remember hearing so many people saying, I don't want to vote for either one of these. Like, I can't believe that I have to choose between these two. Like, isn't there a third option somewhere? Now, you might find yourself feeling somewhat similar, actually, when you look at today's texts. Because like a presidential election, it's actually concerned with who's going to be the leader. Only in this case, it's concerned with who's going to be the next leader of God's people. And as we saw last week, as we've been going through this book of Genesis, Isaac, Abraham's son, has been leading God's people, but he's getting old now. And God has chosen Isaac's son, Jacob, to succeed him. But Isaac's got some other plans. He supports his son Esau as the next leader. But his wife, Rebekah, she supports their son Jacob. And as we look at this chapter, it is just filled with political subterfuge. And there's scheming and manipulation and misinformation campaigns. And as we get to know these people, we get to know this family, we get to know these two sons who are kind of vying for the blessing in this chapter, you're going to find your nose starting to wrinkle, and you're going to find yourself thinking, really? It has to be one of these? Isn't there another option? Do we really have to pick one of these two characters? That's because there's no heroes in this story. Not one. Isaac's not a hero. His wife Rebecca's not a hero. Neither the sons, Isaac or Jacob, are heroes. The only thing you're going to find in this story is messed up people. And so it would seem that God's plan's actually under threat. It would seem like maybe God's plan is going to be derailed. Now, just back up for a moment, just a reminder of where we are in the story. The overall kind of big picture that's going on in the book of Genesis is it is chronicling the preservation and the growth of the woman's offspring in spite of hostility from the serpent offspring. Now, if you're like, what in the world are you talking about? And you missed some of our early sermons, don't worry, I'll catch up real quick. In the garden, Satan came in the form of a serpent, and he deceived Adam and Eve. And as a result, God said there's going to be hostility between the woman's offspring, which isn't talking about every human ever, it's just talking about those who are God's people, and the serpent's offspring. Those among humanity who do not follow God. So there's hostility between the woman's offspring and the serpent's offspring, spring between God's people and those who are not God's people. And as we've continued on in Genesis, we've seen, like, man, it seems like the serpent offspring has just taken over everything. And the whole question of, well, God said that eventually the woman's offspring is going to crush the head of the serpent. Like, is that ever going to happen? And yet God's plan is that the woman's offspring will prevail. God's plan is that it's going to, starting kind of with Abraham's family, it was going to begin to expand, and it would spread and spread and spread until it covers the whole earth. Of course, we know the end of the story. We know that it spread and became the nation of Israel, and then we know that out of the nation of Israel, the true promised offspring, Christ, came, and he's the one who ultimately crushes the head of the serpent. But now when we're joined to Christ, we're part of the family of God, we're part of the woman's offspring, and the church continues to spread and will continue to spread until every nation, tongue, and tribe is declaring the greatness of our King. And when Christ comes back, this triumph of the woman's offspring will be put on display, and the serpent will be finally thrown into the lake of fire. And yet, in Genesis, we're really early on in this story. And the problem that we're seeing right now is like, okay, there's this plan for the woman's offspring, but at the moment, it's only one family on the entire earth. The entire earth is the serpent's offspring, except for this one family, and this one family is constantly under threat. We've seen this in Genesis. We saw last week they were under threat from famine. They were under threat from some hostile rulers. And now this week we're going to see that not only is the threat outside the family, there's also threat from within the family. Because the family's filled with messed up people. And not only is it some of God's messed up people, this family also contains itself, offspring of the serpent. Within the one family, we've got woman's offspring and we've got serpent offspring. And so the question this prompts is, wow, what happens when there's this collision between God's people and the world's people? And in particular, since we're looking at this through the lens of the New Testament, what happens when a messed up world collides with a messed up church? And I don't mean just like a kind of messed up in the, oh yeah, we're all sinners sort of way. I mean, sometimes there are people in God's family that are really messed up. What happens when a messed up world collides with a messed up church? Will God's plan stay on track? Can God's plan survive that kind of a collision? Maybe you're here this morning and you're on the Jesus train. Maybe you've been on this train for a long time. And you've given money to it, and you've spent your life seeking to conform your character to and surrender to Christ and live according to the image of Christ. Maybe you've given your talents to God and to his people, but and yet you look in our culture and you look at what's going on, you see this collision coming, a collision that's greater than maybe any of the collisions that you've experienced, a collision that's greater just than just like, okay, I want this, God says this, and your desires kind of collide a little bit. Maybe you look out into our culture and you see this massive collision between the church and culture coming, and you recognize the church itself is all messed up. So we got a messed up church creating with a messed up culture, and you just wonder, what's going to happen to this train I'm on? Is God's plan really going to stay on track? Because maybe you haven't really had to question it that much in the past because things were stable enough that it seemed plausible. But maybe now when you look out into the political landscape, it seems a little less plausible. Or maybe you're thinking about hopping onto the Jesus train, but you're wondering if it's really worth the sacrifice because it is a call to die. It is a call to pick up your cross and follow Christ. And there's some excruciating elements to it where there's aspects of our desires that we say no to and we put them to death and we let them get pulled up by the roots so that they can be removed so that we can say yes to God. And you're wondering, is it really worth it to hop onto this train when I'm not even sure it's going to arrive because I see the collision coming? Culture's certainly saying this is the wrong train to be on. And there's increasing hostility towards being on this train. And maybe you're here this morning, you're just a part of that hostility. You got no interest in the Jesus train. And you're like, I actually think that train is a dead-end track, and there's much other better trains to be on. I'm investing elsewhere. And no matter where you're at, I'd like you to hear what this text is telling us, that it's that all these tracks, when they all come together to this climactic moment, there's only one train that's going to emerge. There's only one train that's going to keep going, and it's God's train. And so if you're nervous about God's train, I want to encourage you. God's train's not getting derailed. It's not getting knocked off the track. If you're not on God's train, I want to warn you. There's only one train that continues on, and it arrives at the true destination. And so I'd encourage everyone, get on board with God's plan. Stay on board with God's plan. If you're already on board, you can relax and enjoy the ride because here's the big takeaway for us this morning. God's plan isn't derailed. God's plan isn't derailed. We're going to look at this text and we're going to see it seems like there's a bunch of threats that could derail God's plan, but they don't. They don't even come close. So I'm going to show you from Genesis chapter 27, three threats that don't derail God's plan. I'm going to show you that God's plan isn't derailed by opposition. God's plan isn't derailed by deception. And God's plan isn't derailed by serpent offspring. And before we look at those, let's just ask the Lord for his help. Father God, we come to you. seeking to stay on board your train, seeking confidence that we're on the right train, and seeking and asking you that you would invite others to hop on board. And so, Lord, as I speak, would you speak through me? Lord, would you use my words, and would they be more than my words? God, we ask that your Holy Spirit would speak to all of us. God, I want to hear from you, and I'd like all of us here to hear from you. Would you work in our midst this morning and cause your word to press itself deep into our hearts and come alive and transform us in our chairs so that we leave refreshed, encouraged, different, challenged, obedient. Pray this in Jesus' name, amen. So the first of three threats that do not derail God's plan is that God's plan isn't derailed by opposition. We're going to pick up the story in the very end of Genesis chapter 26. Look with me at verse 34. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son?" And he answered and said, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." I want to help you understand what's going on here. It's not only Isaac's physical sight that has dimmed. The text is giving us clues and will continue to give us clues that his spiritual sight has dimmed also. He's actually opposing God's plan here. And you say, "Barry, how is he doing that?" Well, if you remember where we were a couple weeks ago, Isaac knew what God had told Rebekah when she inquired about her difficult pregnancy. Romans 9 talks about this. It says, "Before the twins were born or had done anything good or bad, in order that God's purpose in election might stand, not by works, but by him who calls, she was told, 'The older will serve the younger.'" In other words, Isaac knew Jacob was God's choice, not Esau. And not only that, but Isaac knew that Esau had shown himself to be unfit. We saw in chapter 5 that Esau had despised his birthright. I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but we saw that what that meant was he was actually showing spiritual contempt towards God's covenant. Spiritual contempt. Hebrews says he's godless. And now in the verses we're looking at this morning, we see that he's showing spiritual contempt again by marrying these pagan wives. And this is way different than what had happened with his own dad. He knew the story. He knew that it was so important for covenant offspring not to intermarry with the Canaanites that his grandfather Abraham had sent a servant on a 400-mile journey. It was at least 3 weeks each way to find Isaac's wife and bring her back. Esau knows all this. And he's basically just spitting in God's face. He's like, "I don't care about any of that. I'm marrying who I want to. I'm marrying these pagan Hittites who were from among the Canaanites." And so he's again showing himself to be godless. He's again showing that he's treating the covenant with this spiritual contempt. Isaac knows this, and yet Isaac is determined to enact a secret plan to declare Esau to be lord over his brother. And we'll see that when we get to verse 29. That's what he wants to declare Esau to be, lord over his brothers. And this is because Isaac is attempting to thwart God's plan. You say, "Well, why this opposition?" Well, for Isaac, it's as simple as the fact that Esau was his favorite. We read this in chapter 25. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. And so now Isaac wants Esau to go get some of that game, and he wants this to be a part of the blessing, and he's got the secret plan. It's not family planning. This is family division, a moment that should have the whole family coming together for this special blessing. It's Isaac and Esau off in the corner doing their secret thing. Isaac is opposed to God's plan, and it kind of prompts the question, like, well, Can he actually get away with this? Can opposition derail God's plan? Well, I'm kind of sharing this story with the end in mind, that we're going to see that no, opposition does not derail God's plan. And but at this point in the story, that hasn't yet become clear. And so for those who are wondering how this works, how God feels in these moments, I just step out of the text for a moment and direct you to Psalm chapter 2. If you want to know how God feels when people plot against his leaders, when people plot against his plan, Psalm 2 just really is encouraging to the church. It should be really encouraging to your heart. You should take courage because God laughs in the face of opposition. I mean, it's the ultimate, you and what army? It's really what's going on. Psalm 2, look at what it says. The psalmist says, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? And the plot here is against those God has chosen to rule. Ultimately, it's against Christ, but it's fulfilled in Israel in the person of their king. It's fulfilled in human history as people conspire against Christ and against God and his rule. And we're seeing a similar thing here happening. God's got a chosen leader and the serpent is conspiring against him. Why do the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. There's this political subterfuge again saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. And here's how God is. He who sits in the heaven is really nervous. And he starts wringing his hands, and he starts biting his fingernails and sweating bullets. No, he's not sweating bullets. It says, he who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. We should never fear that God's plan's about to be thwarted. We should never fear that God is absent, that God is powerless. Stories like this, even these are smaller ones relatively compared to other stories in the Bible. It just shows that at every level, God's in control. At every level, God's got a plan. God's got his plan's not going to stop. And so, church, you can be encouraged. I would give you a little warning here. Isaac has shown strong faith in the past. We saw him praying when they were childless. We saw him obeying God and staying when there was famine. We've seen him demonstrate great faith. And yet, as he's getting older, he's giving in to compromise. And so I would encourage you now and every day and throughout your life that you resolve inside, I'm going to finish strong. And then you look at these guys who probably also resolved to finish strong and don't just trust your own strength. Come to God and say, God, I'm resolving to finish strong, but by the power of your spirit, would you make this so? And then trust that he who began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it in you, and make it your resolution and your prayer that I am not going to settle as I get older. I'm not going to look back and say, yeah, I did good stuff. I think I've built up enough equity with God. I can kind of cool down when it comes to my faith now. After all, I've retired. I did stuff for the church for a number of years, but you know, I can kind of cool off. Now I can slow down a little. Let's let someone else put their faith into practice. No. Stay strong to the end. Don't grow weary in doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. Resolve to finish strong all your days, and then ask God to make it so. So, the first threat we see that doesn't derail God's plan is that God's plan isn't derailed by opposition. Let me take a moment to wipe the spittle off my notes. The second threat that doesn't derail God's plan isn't derailed by deception. And we're going to see in this story deception from God's own people. Actually, Rebekah's deception and Jacob's deception. So let's start with Rebekah's deception. Let's continue on the story in verse 5. And as we read this, I want you to note the divisive language. Esau is referred to as his son, Isaac's son. And Jacob is referred to as her son, Rebekah's son. It's not their sons. There's his son. There's her son. There's his political party and his candidate, her political party, her candidate. All these politics are kind of coming to, I wonder what the dinner table discussions were like. I've got no idea. But verse 5, here's what we see. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. Maybe this is like Watergate and they're recording some of the plans of the opposition. I don't know. Verse 6, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord, before I die. The main point's not the food. The food is emphasizing, first off, that Isaac's kind of just being led by his stomach, but also that this is a very special ceremonial event. It's significant. And what's significant is the passing on of the blessing and this desire of Isaac for Esau to be lord over his brothers. And so Rebekah's got a counter plan. She's like, now therefore, verse 8, my son, obey my voice as I command you. She's the campaign manager here. Go to the flock and bring me 2 good young goats so that I may prepare them, or from them, delicious food for your father, such as he loves, and you shall bring it to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies. And so Rebekah's trying to take advantage of the fact that Isaac can't see that well, and she intends to use the sinful deception to help God's plan along. She's all for God's plan of Jacob, and she's gonna basically use whatever means she can to ensure that God's plan happens. And I don't know if that she's so concerned that it's God's plan. It also happens to be her plan. And so she really wants to make sure that her plan happens, and it's always great when you can use God to justify your own plan. Verse 11, but Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I'm a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and he actually turns out to be right. This happens, as we'll see. And I shall seem to be mocking him, and I'll bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing. So Jacob is concerned. But these aren't good concerns. He's not coming to his mom's like, Mom, how could you be thinking this? This is really deceptive. He's like, yeah, no, Mom, I like where you're going, but I'm not sure if this is going to work. He's more concerned about the consequences, verse 15. But he decides to go along with it, and so Rebekah comes up with an answer to his concerns. Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. So if you're wondering how hairy this dude is, like the Bible's not exaggerating when it says that Esau was hairy. Verse 17, and she put the delicious food which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. I just want to push pause, call time out on the story just for a moment to ask this question. So, I mean, it sort of ends up working. So is it okay to sin if it's for a good cause? Is it okay to sin if you're helping God's plan out? And I would suggest that there is a man after God's own heart that the scripture talks about who found himself in a situation where he could have used sinful treachery to help God's plan along, and yet he didn't. And there's a reason God chose that person to be the one whose kingdom would last forever. And I'm talking about David. Of course, most of you know the story. David was called out of the sheep field by the prophet Samuel, and he was anointed to be the next king over Israel. And so here's what David did. He immediately went to the nearest Walmart and started crown shopping. And putting all robes up. No, he actually went right back out into the field. Didn't seem like he was taking it on himself to manipulate God's plan into happening. In fact, when the moments came when he could very easily have helped God's plan along and everyone would have given him 2 thumbs up, he didn't do it. He found himself, all right, fleeing from Saul, who was the king when David was anointed the next king. And so David hides in this cave. Saul comes into that cave to defecate. And David ends up being so close to Saul, Saul doesn't even know it, close enough that David could actually reach out and touch Saul's robe. And everyone with David is like, the Lord has delivered him into your hands. Kill him. Like, this is God. But David's like, no. I'm not going to touch the Lord's. I'm not going to touch him. I'm going to leave this in God's hands and wait for God's timing. A little bit later, David and some others, they go. They're spying out the enemy camp, and it says that the Lord put Saul's soldiers into a deep sleep. And so there they are, right by King Saul, able to grab his spear and grab his water jug. And again, David's men are recognizing, can't you see that God's doing this? The Bible even tells us God's put them all to sleep. He's like, look, I can just pin him to the ground here while he sleeps. David's like, no. And David makes the point, I'm not going to manipulate this. God can accomplish this in his way and in his timing, whether Saul dies of old age or whether he dies in battle. Like, I'm leaving this in God's hands. I'm not going to do evil things in order to try to help God's plan along. He trusted God to bring about his own plan, and that is the exact opposite of what we see Rebecca doing in this story. That's what she should have done. Rebecca and Jacob should have trusted that God could get this done in God's own way and God's own timing, but Rebecca didn't. She took matters into her own hands, and yes, in a sense, God's plan still happens, but there's disastrous results that come as a result of this, and it's because you reap what you sow. And so Rebecca sows this vendetta against Esau, but as we'll see, she reaps a murderous vendetta against Jacob in return. Rebecca seeks to displace Esau, and yet her son also is displaced, and he ends up having to flee away, doesn't come back for 20 years, and as far as we can tell, she never saw him again, her favorite son. So yeah, in one sense, the plan worked, but sin always has consequences. We see Jacob, he reaps what he sows. He uses goat skins to deceive. He uses goat to deceive. Later on, when we get to the story of Joseph, he himself gets deceived by a goat. They smear goat's blood on Joseph's coat and make it look like Joseph's dead. They reap what they sow. So this text is not trying to tell us that the end justifies the means. And it's not trying to say it's okay to sin if it's for a good cause. Galatians 6:7 says, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. And so the end doesn't justify the means. And this is true in all kinds of areas in life. It's true politically. It matters how politicians go about doing what they do. It's not just, well, good will result, so I'll do evil to get there. No, it matters. This is true when it comes to our finances. We can't just say, well, I'll have more money and then I can be more generous, or I can do more good things for my family so I can cut corners here, or I can cheat on my taxes, or I don't need to be generous for a while, or I can do some shady dealings. Like, no, it matters that we have integrity when it comes to our finances. Even if we can say, well, it's for a good cause, the means matters as well as the end when it comes to God. This is true with our morality. We can't say, well, love's a good thing, and so whatever I do in the name of love, the end justifies the means. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Scripture is very clear on this. When it comes to our relationships and our family, we can't just say, well, it's for a family or it's for a friend. And so we compromise, whether it's we compromise in regards to our spirituality or church or character, or like the end doesn't justify the means. And so here we see Rebecca's like, well, it's for my son. Well, it's for God's good plan. And so, you know, yes, it's a deceit, but look at Isaac's rebelling, and so we can't let that happen, and so the end justifies the means, right? No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever one sows, that he will also reap. What Rebecca should have done, and what this text would invite us to do, so that we don't experience some of the same consequences Rebecca experienced, would be to learn to rest instead of manipulate. Rest. Trust that God's got this. God's plan doesn't come across through human striving. Now, I don't mean that we don't work hard and that we don't sacrifice and that we're not sold out for God, but that means we can rest from human fear, human anxiety, human manipulation, human contrivance. That's not God's way. We're called to honest work, not conniving and striving. We're called to trust in God, not to trust in our effort, even though we give effort. All right, let's move on to Jacob's deception. So we've seen Rebecca's deception, but Jacob's involved right along with her, verse 18. So Jacob went into his father and said, my father. And Isaac said, here I am. Who are you, my son? Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. Probably trying to talk as hairy as he could. I've done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game that your soul may bless me. But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, so spiritual, "Because the Lord your God gave me success." Hypocrisy. Verse 21. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you really are my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, you almost see a thought bubble here. The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands, so he blessed him. Verse 24. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be anyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." So Jacob's deception actually succeeds in a certain sense. I mean, he must have looked ridiculous. He must have felt ridiculous. And yet Isaac fell for it. And maybe the text is trying to help us understand that it's not only his sight that has dimmed, but to a certain extent, his common sense as well. I mean, does goat really taste like venison? Does goat skin really feel like human hair? Can Jacob's voice really pass for Esau's? In fact, this text shows us all five senses fail Isaac. His eyes were blind, his smell misled him, his taste deceived him, his touch fooled him, and he failed to trust his ears, which actually could have helped him. And so the result is he gives this three-part blessing to Jacob that he'll state in a moment. He recognizes it's irrevocable. He just recognizes that God was speaking when he said this, and it's not true that just because he meant to say it over Esau, it's true of Esau. He'll say later on, this was God. Jacob's blessed. And he gives this three-part blessing to Jacob of wealth, power, and then blessings and cursings working in his favor. The wealth, the fatness of the earth, and the plenty of grain and wine, and then the power, people serving him, being lord over his brothers, and then anyone, just like was true of Abraham, anyone who blessed Abraham was blessed. So that's true of Jacob. And just as was true of Abraham, that anyone who cursed him would be cursed, now that's true of Jacob, and it's just showing that Jacob stands in line to inherit the covenant promises from Abraham. Isaac was the seed of the woman, just like Abraham was the seed of the woman, just like Abel was the seed of the woman, and now it's Jacob who is the seed or the offspring of the woman. And so this means Isaac's plan to oppose God failed. It failed. But it might also raise the question, like, so has Jacob's deception actually derailed God's plan? Like, if God picked Jacob, but now Jacob is showing himself also to be disqualified, isn't this kind of like, I mentioned Watergate earlier, in 1972, there was some secret, you know, breaking into Democratic headquarters. This is when Richard Nixon was president, and then he began to use deceit to cover this up, because he wanted to stay in power. So he was using deceit in order to keep himself in power and to pursue political power. But when the deception was revealed, then the game was up for Nixon. And the Senate drew up articles of an impeachment, and he ended up resigning. And so when your candidate is in power, but deceit is revealed, it's all over for them. It would almost seem like, shouldn't that be true of Jacob? I mean, if a president should have to, you know, not continue in power because of deceit, like, doesn't God have standards? Like, how could this work? Like, is deception going to derail God's plan, even in God's own candidate? Shouldn't it make him lose power, not gain power? And here's just what's good about God. God is so far beyond human comprehension that even the most despicable political deceptions in human history served only to accomplish God's greatest triumph. And actually, we see this very clearly when we look at the cross. The disciples described this when they all gathered together to pray in Acts chapter 4. And they pray to God, and they're talking to God here and saying, "There were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus a bunch of people who use deception." First, let me read the verse. "They were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel." And then notice this phrase, "to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." So there was this plan against God, and yet somehow God just looked back and said, "All right," and he just incorporated that plan right into his plan, and they ended up planning against God, and yet their plan against God ended up being God's plan, and it turned out they were just kind of puppets the whole time. Now, I'm not saying our choice doesn't matter and that we're just puppets, but I want to show you how God can look at human failure and instead of that derailing his plan so he has to start again, he's just sovereign over it all, and he incorporates it into such a way that all things work together for his people. And so here in Jerusalem with Jesus, there's all sorts of deception that leads up to the cross. So we've got Judas giving a deceptive kiss. We've got Peter lying about being a disciple. We've got the Jews. They brought false witnesses in order to convict Christ. We have Pilate claiming false innocence as he condemns Jesus. And yet, did any of that do anything to derail God's plan? No. All it did was bring about the very thing that God said was going to happen in the first place. God actually turned all that evil into something good. God's plan is so certain that even evil human deceptions did nothing more than bring about the very thing that they had been designed to prevent, which was Jesus continuing in power and the message spreading. They were trying to shut that all down. And yet everything they did actually brought about what was necessary. The cross was necessary. Everything they did just brought about what was necessary for God's plan to triumph. And that is really comforting to me. That God can work even fallen human beings into his plan and bring something good out of it. So does that excuse sin? No, absolutely not. In fact, we see that there was consequences for Jacob's deception. There's consequences for Rebecca's deception. The people who killed Christ are held to account for that. There's consequences for that. Does it make God responsible for sin? No, the Bible never speaks that way. It speaks of our choices as real choices. These men did the sin. It wasn't God doing the sin through them. We're responsible for our sins. So does that excuse sin? No. Does it make God responsible for sin? No. But does it mean that we can be confident in God's plan? You bet it does. In fact, God's plan there at the cross is the reason we can have any sort of confidence in God, because in the midst of all that sin and disciples betraying and bringing about the cross, they were bringing about the very thing they needed. They needed the cross because they had blown it so bad, and we're not that different than them. We all should have been the one hanging on the cross. So all this sin's happening, and in the midst of that, Christ is like, "Yeah, I'll die for you. I'll die for you, Peter, denying me. I'll die for you, Jews, who are taking me to the cross. I'll die for Jacob, who deceived me. I'll die for Brandon and Steve and Lindsay and everyone in this room. We all should have been there. Our sin should have wrecked the plan. It should have ruined the plan that we get to be with God forever. It should have wrecked everything. It should have wrecked that there should be no earth filled with people manifesting God's glory." And yet God went to the cross for those kind of people. And he knew before he even came to the earth that we were going to do this. And he had a plan. Like, Christ was crucified before the foundation of the world. Before God even created the first man, he had already figured out a way to incorporate our sinful choices into his plan, so nothing's going to stop what's coming. And that it's Christ glorified. And every nation bowing before him, our future eternal, with God wiping away tears from our eyes, remaking the earth, giving us glorified bodies, removing our sinful hearts, and placing us with one that can no longer sin. That's all coming. God's plan's coming about. So when we see sin in God's people, we shouldn't think, "Oh no, God's plan is derailed." Nope. God's plan is not derailed. by human deception. And this should give us some sort of comfort in our world right now. When you look around and you see misinformation campaigns, when you see people just posting something completely false on Facebook, when you see both political parties misrepresenting the truth, you can be confident God's plan's on track. He's never been derailed by misinformation campaigns. When you see a messed up church, it can be very easy to say, well, the world's messed up. We've got this. What we're seeing here in Isaac's family is even God's people are messed up. When you look around and see a messed up church, don't jump off the Jesus train. Don't conclude that God's plan is derailed. God's dealt with messed up people in his family before. Yeah, there's consequences. I'm not saying that there's not consequences for that kind of stuff. But we can have confidence that God's plan won't be derailed. God's plan is not derailed by deception. And the third and final threat that will not derail God's plan, and I'm not saying these are the only threats that come up, but they're the only threats we see in this particular text. God's plan's not derailed by serpent offspring. And Esau proves to be serpent offspring. And I don't mean by that he's a Hitler, but he doesn't belong to God. And you either belong to the offspring of the woman, you belong to God, or you belong to the offspring of the serpent, and you don't. So verse 30, here's how the story finishes. As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, his father, Esau, his brother, came in from his hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" He answered, "I'm your son, your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled very violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me, and I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him? Yes, and he shall be blessed." As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob?" Which we saw meant like heel grasper or supplanter, one who kind of outwits by trickery. "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he's taken away my blessing." Then he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I've made him lord over you, and all his brothers I've given to him for servants. And with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. When he'll be dead, we'll have a funeral. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." So just as Cain, the first of the serpent's offspring, had desired to murder Abel, who was the first of the woman's offspring, so now Esau becomes linked with the serpent, linked with Cain through his desire to kill Jacob. And there's actually a kind of a reversal of the birth narrative, because when the birth happened, it was Jacob that was grasping at Esau's heel as he came out of the womb. And so he was named Jacob, and his name came to mean kind of to outwit. Well, now it's Esau who arrives right on Jacob's heel, and Esau's the one who's grasping. And so we see here in the story that Esau has actually changed the opinion of the birthright. He now regrets that he sold it, and he's actually trying to find a way to go back on his deal. He's like, I don't like what I sold that for. I want my birthright back. Or if I can't have the birthright, maybe I can separate the blessing out from it. I can undercut the birthright by at least having the blessing. But it's all to no avail. Instead, he receives an anti-blessing. There's actually a shift in Isaac when he says, yes, he shall be blessed. We'll see in a moment that at that point, Isaac is surrendering. And then when he declares the anti-blessing, he's no longer trying to force Esau to be what he is not. He is declaring over Esau what God has declared over Esau, even though it's not what Isaac himself preferred. And so Esau received this anti-blessing. It's not the dew and the fatness and the wealth for him, but to be away from them. His descendants are going to live by the sword. They're going to be subservient. So Esau becomes the nation of Edom, which for a long time was subservient to the nation of Israel. Israel always had a greater place, and to this day has the primary place when it comes to nations and God's plan. Eventually, Edom broke off the yoke of Israel, but that was a long time down the road, and so everything that Isaac said came true. Now, Esau's trying to put the blame on Jacob. Well, Jacob's the cheater, but the text is telling us that ultimately Esau's responsible for his own actions. He's proven to be godless. When he sold his birthright, he was led by the passions of the moment. He showed spiritual contempt by selling the birthright and despising God's covenant. He showed spiritual contempt by marrying these pagan women. He's trying here to go back on his word and break the oath and get back in on this birthright blessing. And now it leaves off. He wants to murder his brother. The text is telling us Esau is godless. Esau is the serpent's offspring. And the good news for us is, it doesn't derail God's plan. God's plan, yes, this whole family is messed up, but God's plan's not messed up. God's plan's not messed up. Esau does give a warning to us. So Esau, he was trying to be free of the godly lifestyle, but he still wanted blessing. The warning is that if we choose to be godliness, the only freedom that ultimately comes with is the freedom to live unblessed. It's the freedom to receive the anti-blessing. In the end, the train track of the godless does not arrive at the destination. And so I would just warn anyone here who is just like, I'm not sure I want to be on this Jesus train. If you oppose God, in the end, you'll get nowhere. Your train might seem like it's zooming along, and there might be some nice scenery for a while, and it might seem like your train goes pretty fast, and you think you can see where you're going, but you're going to find out that it plunges off a bridge at some point. You oppose God, you get nowhere. You oppose God, you're only going to end up hurting yourself. And so the invitation of this text is to respond like Isaac. And Isaac eventually gets to his point where he surrenders. Surrender. Say to God, your will be done. This is what so we see here in Isaac. So first, Isaac trembles violently. This is, in other words, it's a life-shattering earthquake as his dreams and plans for his son are revealed to be an idol that he's worshiping, and they shatter into a million pieces. And he recognizes, okay, I've been fighting God. And I can either be shattered or I can surrender. He submissively surrenders when he says, yes, Jacob will be blessed. He doesn't try to come deal with God. It's like, okay, God, but when I said that, I thought I was talking about Esau. This is him coming and saying, okay, like God's plan's not going to be derailed. And no matter what I do to fight it, this is going to happen. And so he is surrendering. And this was actually a confession of faith. When he says, yes, and he shall be blessed, it's a confession of faith. And we know this from the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 11:12. Isaac actually finds himself in God's faith hall of fame, which Hebrews 11 lists all these Christ, or all of God's people. And it's kind of a hall of fame for those who trusted God. And it says, by faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. Now, it's not talking about what Isaac thought he was saying. He wasn't operating in faith at first at all. He was operating in faith when he said, yes, and he shall be blessed. That was him surrendering, trusting God. And then when he spoke over Esau, this was a sign, I am now surrendered to God. I'm not fighting anymore. I'm trusting in what God says. It's Jacob who's going to be blessed. It's not Esau who's going to be blessed, even though Esau is my son that I love. And so the text is inviting us to get on board with God's plan, because God's plan's not going to be derailed. That's what you need to hear. It's super comforting if you're on the Jesus train. God's plan's not going to be derailed. It's super scary if you're not on the train. And so the invitation is, get on board. But then once you're on board, church, we can relax and enjoy the ride, because the train's going to arrive at the destination. I know things look crazy in America right now. And forget America. Things might look crazy in your own life. And you might find yourself tempted to wonder if God's plan for your life is off track. And I just want you to know it's not. It's not. God's plan isn't derailed. It's not derailed by opposition, whether it's from God's family or it's from the world. It's not derailed by deception, whether it's from God's people or the world's people. And it's not going to be derailed by the serpent offspring. And ultimately, it's not going to be derailed by the serpent himself. Amen? God's plan is not derailed.